You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Campaigning to end the centuries-old practice of female genital cutting was the furthest thing from Molly Melching's mind when she arrived in Dakar in 1974 as a 24-year-old graduate student. But a sharp decrease in that practice in Senegal and several other African countries is just one of the results of a community-driven education program for women that Ms. Melching created and implemented over the next 40 years. Her work has been cited by Melinda Gates, Forbes magazine, and others as an example of how development work should be done in Africa. And the organization she founded, Tostan, was awarded the prestigious $1.5 million Conrad N. Hilton Humanitarian Prize in 2007. Amy Molloy tells Molly Melching's story in her latest book, However Long the Night. It's published by Harper One, and I'm very pleased that it brings Amy Molloy and Molly Melching to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, thank you very much.
Amy, we often hear the practice we are discussing called female genital mutilation, but you call it female genital cutting throughout your book. Are the two terms interchangeable?
Well, I have to say, before I got involved in writing the book, I probably myself would refer to it as female genital mutilation. But it was Molly who, as I write about in the book, who really showed me why that's not the best way to approach the topic.
But it does involve a mutilation. You've said you avoid using any language in your work, Molly, that implies judgment or moral condemnation. Is that why you say cutting instead?
I really use the word female genital cutting because of all of our participants who are out in the field, who are living in villages, and who actually said to me, we hear that you call this mutilation. And mutilation means cutting with the intention of harming. But we don't intend to harm our girls. We're doing this because we believe this is important for girls if they're going to be married.
And you learn to avoid using any language that carries shame because that usually shuts down the rest of the discussion?
Exactly. As soon as you start blaming and shaming people and saying, oh, this is awful, what you're doing is horrible, to people who believe that what they're doing is good for their girls and that they believe it will help them to be respected in the community above all, then when you start speaking that language, they turn off. They don't listen to you anymore.
But you weren't the only person who might have used that language. When they went to doctors, didn't they have to deal with that?
Certainly, but the doctors would call it mutilation, and I think the villagers were the ones who told me that when they heard that word, it was very shocking to them because it was as if they were trying to hurt their girls when, in fact, they were trying to help their girls. They believed that what they were doing would prepare their girls to be good marriage partners and that they would be respected in the community. And it's only when they went through the program and learned the consequences of this practice that they hadn't realized. I mean, you have to understand that all of the participants in our program really have never been to school. And they certainly don't learn these things often in school.
Well, a few years ago, the late great Senegalese filmmaker Ousmane Sembène made a film called Mulade, which is about a women's revolt against female genital cutting. Does that reflect that attitudes are changing?
Ousmane was a very good friend of mine, by the way, and he was both influenced by the work we were doing in the communities, and I was also very influenced by Ousmane and the importance of working in national languages, of really understanding people, understanding why they were practicing female genital cutting. And, you know, you have to understand that we had a basic education program, and we were teaching health. And I said, as an American, I said, oh, my gosh, I can't really approach this issue because it's so sensitive. And I, as an American, might be seen as judging. But then when I realized all the danger and the harm, and the women themselves said, please bring this up, it's when we started working on it. And then Ousmane, he became very interested because he saw the reaction in the communities. He saw women standing up and men and children saying this is a harmful practice. And he decided to show how women can be the ones to lead a movement to abandon the practice.
But this is also an issue for people outside of Africa. Germaine Greer, the noted feminist, once chided me on the show for being critical of the practice. She said I was applying paternalistic and judgmental Western ideals to other people's cultural traditions.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's a hard topic to talk about among Western cultures because, you know, as Molly said, and, you know, this goes back to the using the term mutilation, is people say this is horrible. This is a terrible thing that you're doing to your daughters. But I think you have to really understand that it is the purest act of love, I think, that a mother can do to her daughter. Because to not do it, it would be setting her up for a future of social isolation and failure. And I think, you know, that in our book, However Long the Night, I think that that's what really I wanted to spend a lot of time talking about, was the respect that you have to bring, that Molly has brought to these traditional practices. And it's only through that respect and understanding, I think, that she's been so successful.
How did you first get interested in Molly's story?
Well, it wasn't a kind of a typical way that writers get books, but I've written a bunch before on human rights issues, and the book, which is published by Harper One, it's a partnership with the Skoll Foundation, which was started by Jeff Skoll, and they got together and decided that they wanted to do a book about, you know, people doing social justice work, and they chose Molly as the first topic, and then they invited me to be the writer on the book.
Had you spent any time in Africa before?
I'd written a previous book, Jansen's Gift, which was about the child slave trade in Ghana, West Africa. So I'd been there a couple times, but I'd never been to Senegal before.
And how much time were you able to spend there with Molly and the other members of Tostan when you were doing your research?
Quite a bit over, you know, it was sort of a short process, but maybe over the course of a year, I was there for three times, a couple weeks at a time, and Molly came back to the United States a couple times, and we, you know, it's been weeks together.
Now, where does the name Tostan come from, Molly?
Tostan is actually a word that one of the most brilliant African thinkers loved. He loved the word Tostan because it meant spread, the spread of knowledge for him. It literally means the hatching of an egg. And he always told me he if I'd ever started an organization, Tostan would be the perfect word. And so I when I did start Tostan, I thought of him and I thought, wow, this is what we're trying to do, is that teaching people so they have the information they need to make their own decisions. Because in Tostan, you know, we never told people to abandon this practice. And we have many, many other results. Certainly, female genital cutting was not our goal. And I think that may be one reason why people then felt that they could, because it wasn't like we were trying to pressure them to do this. They got the information that they didn't have about health and about the risks and what was really going on with this. They often thought, for example, that if there were problems, it was due to evil spirits. They thought there was someone had, you know, done something against them. Someone didn't like them or didn't want them to succeed, and so had, you know, put some kind of sanction on them some way, and they didn't see it as really being this health issue, and they didn't understand. When they did understand what actually happens, they were the first to stand up and say, oh my goodness, if this is what the consequences of this practice are, we must stop. And they were the ones. This is what's interesting about Tostan. In our program and in the sessions we did within the Women's Health module, we never asked people to stop. We merely gave them the information they would need to make those important decisions that would affect their lives. And they were the ones who first stood up and abandoned the practice.
Now, I'm not going to call it female genital cutting anymore. FGC, can I use that?
Yes, absolutely.
Many Westerners assume that the problem of FGC is intractable because it's mandated or tied to religious beliefs. Was that your assumption when you first arrived in Senegal?
I really knew nothing about the practice when I arrived in Senegal. I just was shocked one day when I went to visit during the break, the Christmas break. I was invited to go to Mauritania, and I was sitting in the house, and a man came over who was a student at the university, an intellectual who was learning to be a doctor, and said that his daughter was being cut. And I said, what? I really didn't know.
A doctor was doing that?
He was learning.
Isn't it done rather unhygienically?
It's done by usually elder women who are specialists in that practice and who are known as the circumcisers, ones who actually are in charge of doing that. And it depends on the ethnic group, how it is done. He was the one. I said, what? How can you allow this to happen to your daughter? He said, I have no control over this whatsoever. If I said now, don't do this to my daughter, it would be done when I'm gone. I would rather be here if something happens to my daughter. And I said, how can you allow this? I was so shocked. And he said, Molly, these are traditions that are so deep, you will never understand. And that is where I first got my introduction to this practice and realized how deep and how how important it was to the people who were doing it, and how people who were actually against it, because he knew there was a danger, could do nothing against it.
Because it's such a deep-seated tradition, Amy, is there any religious basis for this? Is there mention of it in the Quran?
There's not, even though, you know, most women, I would say, when Molly started this work, you know, I write about the first group of women in a small village called Malakunda Bambara. They had gone through the Toast Down program. They were the first women in Senegal who stood up and publicly said, now that I understand, we're not going to cut our daughters anymore. And it was really what led to what I think is, you know, one of the most significant human rights movements of the time. But at the time, those women needed to understand, because, you know, that it was not a religious obligation, and they had to go to the religious leaders and they had to talk to them about that. And
does anyone know how this tradition began?
We believe, how it became connected, but the first references to it were in Egypt under the pharaohs. And we learned that from any of the references that we have, that it was a pharaoh who did this to control the sexuality of the women in his harem, and that it was really done for that purpose. But then over the years, it became associated somehow with purity and a good woman who would not sort of run around. And so it just became part of the practices and the traditions of certain groups. Not everyone practices this female genital cutting in Africa, but among those who picked it up, and a lot of people do believe that it came down with the migration from Egypt and across Africa through to all the way to Senegal. And so they believe that this was a practice that was in the Quran, and the women were very surprised when they learned. And as Amy says, in Malakunda Bambara, the first community where the women stood up and abandoned, they were shocked to learn that this was not a religious practice. And the imam, the religious leader in their community, said, I didn't cut my girls myself. And they said, what? They had no idea that the imam himself, their religious leader, had not done this to their girls. So they started really discussing and thinking about it, and they were the ones who made that decision. And I was, quite frankly, in the beginning, didn't even believe it. I was shocked.
You would think that women, of course, would have been the major objectors, because it eliminates sexual, or cuts down on sexual pleasure. So, and that is its intention, isn't it? But you suggest it also is about controlling people. Is it similar in some ways to foot binding in China?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, one of the researchers who helped Toast Down a lot to better understand the practice and why this was a social norm, and why social norms are very hard to change, because people really believe that they're doing the right thing. And they believed that this was what their religion dictated, and so they believed that they were helping their daughters. It's only when they got the information and learned, just as with foot binding in China, when people started realizing what the consequences of this practice were, and especially when they learned that not everybody was doing it. And I remember going into a village and sitting there, and we were talking with the village chief, and he looked at me and he says, you know, our whole village has abandoned female genital cutting now. And we're wondering, do people in America, have they stopped? Have the women stopped practicing now? And I looked at him. I was so shocked, I didn't know what to say. And I finally said, well, you know, not everyone does practice this. And he said, really? They really thought that all women underwent this. This was something that everyone did.
Actually, a number of women have come here and applied for refugee status, because if they went back, their daughter would be very likely subjected to this, and they want to escape that. And I think that has now become one of the reasons for giving people refugee status in this country. My guests are Amy Molloy, who has written a book called However Long the Night. It's about Molly Melching, who's also here, and her journey to help millions of African women and girls triumph. The book is published by Harper One. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Amy Molloy, who has worked on 8 books, many of them collaborations. The most recent one, The Story of Molly Melching. It's called However Long the Night. It is published by Harper One. Molly and the organization that she founded, Tostan, are best known for the success that they've had reducing the incidence of female genital cutting. But were you surprised when you started this project to learn how many years Molly had worked in Africa before she even began to address FGC and how reluctant she was to take it on when until local women actually approached her about it?
Yeah. You know, to be honest, I had read about Molly's work before I started to work on this book. And when I started to think about taking on this project, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to meet this woman who, you know, has set off on this crusade to end this harmful practice. And it's going to be this, you know, riveting story of this, you know, this fight that she led. And then I met her and went to Senegal and spent a lot of time with her. And I saw that that actually isn't at all what happened. You know, her approach and Tostan's approach is very, it's slow and deliberate. It's a 3-year education program. You know, and I think it's because it's so slow and so deliberate is why it's having such a wonderful result.
How long before you actually got involved in the FGC part of the culture?
I was, most interested in helping communities, women in the rural areas who have never had the opportunity to go to school. I saw how many children were dying and how many problems women had because they didn't have any basic health information. And then also started realizing that they knew nothing about their own human rights. And I realized that this could be very helpful to them. And so we started working on health, and the women themselves said, you know, we want to address this issue because it's very important. We know nothing about it.
Well, it's about sex, and that's always difficult to talk about.
You know, what we found that it wasn't not necessarily about sex for the women. It's that they saw there were problems with the practice of cutting. They saw there were problems with their girls, that they were hemorrhaging, and there was problems later on during childbirth, and they were worried about this because they just didn't know. They didn't have the information. They had never been to school. And they were the ones who said, please tell us about this. Let us know what exactly happens and why we're doing this, and is it really necessary? And it was from this participatory research that our organization, Tostan, and all the people who were working on the team, the women who said, we must really work on this and put it as part of our module on women's health and human rights.
Could you have done this if you hadn't learned to speak Wolof?
Never.
Now, you grew up in the Midwest.
Yes.
How did you wind up in Senegal?
I was very interested in other cultures. I had gone to France. I had spoke French fluently. And then became very interested in teaching French culture. And as part of the course, we discussed Africa and the influence of the French in West Africa. And the opportunity arose for me to go on an exchange program with my university. And I took it immediately. I said, wow, what a great opportunity to really learn about a different culture, because I knew it was very different from France.
And assumed that everyone spoke French because it was a Francophone
Absolutely.
Colony.
I thought I'd go there and everyone would speak French, and maybe 10% of the population speaks French well. But so many of the wonderful people I was meeting did not speak French. And I soon realized that, you know, really almost everyone spoke Wolof. Now, even the other ethnic groups who were that Fulani and other ethnic groups that were in the country, the Mandenkas, and I soon realized that I needed to learn a local language, and I learned Wolof, and that was when I really started learning and penetrating the culture and understanding what was important to people, why they did things. I really started better understanding the culture and their values.
Did it help that you were an outsider?
Perhaps, but you have to understand that I worked very closely with people who were in that culture. And we worked together for years without any other Americans or other nationalities even in the organization of Tostan, because I really believed it was the people themselves that I was working with, the villagers. They were the ones who had to tell us what is the information they needed to know to make really important decisions to better their lives, so they could know health, they could know hygiene, they could know problem solving and do projects and be able to manage their own projects. And that was my intent. And I was very worried about getting into such culturally sensitive issues.
You were teaching reading, writing, math, Because most of these people hadn't had much of an education?
That's right. Almost all the people that we worked with in areas very far out, very remote, in the mountains, and, you know, hard to get to, actually. They didn't even have schools at the time. And I realized that if people have information, they make good decisions. And, you know, I never told people to abandon female genital cutting. I wasn't the one. When they got the information, they made this decision. They were the ones who stood up and said, we want to abandon this practice, and we have to get all of our group together. It's not just one village that can do this alone. We must reach out to all the people with whom we marry, you know, our other villages, and we must do this as a family, an extended family, and if we can do that, we can abandon this practice so that we don't have these health problems that we have seen over the years.
Well, did this grow out of the classes that you added that dealt with human anatomy, health, and human rights? You say that many of the women thought that they had no rights at all as individuals or as women. Now, I'm really surprised because the first leader of Senegal was Senghor, who was world famous for being a very cultured man, a man who wrote poetry, who encouraged the arts in his country. Was there a two-tier system?
I think that Senghor, yes, was very interested in the French culture, the French language. He's well known for all that he has written in French. I think that, however, to really make and help Senegal to move forward, people need to have the information necessary to make decisions around their health, the way they live in their communities, the way they work together, the decisions they make, and they needed to have an education in their own language. And it's when working with someone like Cher Anta Diop, working with Ousmane Sembène, that really Tostan started moving forward, because we were doing basic education, really hard stuff, interesting stuff, that was not it was not giving, you know, just superficial information, telling them do this, don't do that. It was about understanding. You know, we're doing a module now on parental education, and helping them to understand, you know, how children learn and the importance of talking to your baby, interacting with your baby. And, you know, very difficult subjects, but we go into depth and really teach people so they know and they can make their own decisions when they have the good information they need in their own language.
My guests are Molly Melching, who's the subject of a book by Amy Molloy called However Long the Night. It is published by Harper One. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I am Leonard Lopate. Amy, most Westerners assume that the practice of FGC is driven by men in an effort to control the wives and daughters. Maybe that's how it started, but you learn that it's pretty much perpetuated by women. You report that the Senegalese have a derogatory name for women who aren't cut, and uncut women are often treated badly by the women who have undergone the process.
Yeah, I do think that you know, as a Westerner, this is something that is most surprising to people to learn about, that, you know, there it's called the women's tradition. You know, as I learned, men don't know that it's happening. They don't know that it's planned. They often won't even know that their daughter has been cut. And so, you know, I think we tend to look at it as something that men are doing to women, to oppress women. And again, maybe that is why it started, but it's certainly not why it continues.
Wait, weren't you pressured, Molly, to have your daughter, who grew up in Senegal, undergo the procedure?
Well, strangely enough, it was my own daughter who came to me and said, I think I should be cut, like my friends who are in the neighborhood, and they tell me that if I'm not cut, I won't find a good husband. And I was totally shocked. And actually, that was one of the reasons I decided, well, maybe it's time that we start teaching this subject and getting involved in understanding about this issue, which I had been hesitant to do because I knew how sensitive it was. And then even after it started, I was worried because so many people are attached to that tradition, and they think it's important. Sometimes they wrongly associate it with religion. And so it's really was afterwards that I started seeing how many women really want to abandon it, but they just felt like it was a social norm that they could not give up without risking really real deep problems for marriageability of their daughters, of being rejected, of being looked at as someone who doesn't fit into the culture.
Would this only be on the village level? Would people in the capital, Dakar,
have
different attitudes?
No, it's where it's practices, it's widespread. Because everybody is affected by that. Because even if you live in the capital, you have relatives who are in the countryside. And when you go home for vacation, those villagers will think this is such an important part of this daughter's life that they will actually take the girl and have her cut without the parents' knowledge.
Now, Wolof, the language that is most common in Senegal is a really complicated language, a language that would be easy for a foreigner to make a lot of faux pas. Is that a problem when you're dealing with issues like this?
Well, to be quite honest, the Wolof ethnic group itself does not practice female genital cutting. So it's the other ethnic groups that do the practice of female genital cutting. And so that may have helped. That may have been the start of this movement when people realized that other ethnic groups don't practice. And so the issue is that when people are used to this and feel that it is an identity marker for their culture, they really believe that's a religious practice. They are very hesitant to give it up. And this was what we were confronting as a great danger.
Amy, you write that Tustan's leaders were disappointed when the Senegalese government passed a law making female genital cutting illegal in 1999. Why? Isn't this what they were working towards?
Yeah, but, you know, as I discuss in the book, what was happening at the time that the law was passed was there was a grassroots movement that was underway because people had gone through the Tostan classes. And what they had learned, you know, I write specifically about a woman named Wari Sall, who was a traditional cutter for years. And, you know, she was one of the ones who stood up and said, no, we don't want this law passed. We know what we need. We need an education program. We need an understanding of human rights. We need to do that. That's what's going to work, not just telling people to stop it.
So is there going to be a Senegalese feminist movement, a women's movement?
I think there is.
Oh, there is now a great movement. Oh, my goodness. There are thousands of communities in Senegal that now have abandoned, that have come together and said, we are not against our culture. We love our culture. But this is not, this is a tradition. It's a means to an end. And our culture is about health and well-being, about respecting people and wanting them to be able to do what they need to do and be good mothers and fathers. And in order to do that, we need to be in good health. And so we, because we love our daughters, we did it because we loved our daughters and thought we had to do it, but we are abandoning because we love our daughters. And they come together, the religious leaders, the villagers, the women, the men, the children. The children get up and speak about it. They do plays on it. And they talk about human rights, which is very beautiful because they've seen that human rights are so important in improving the lives of thousands of villagers. And they're working on many other issues also, not just this issue. I mean, this
but
is the
FGC
one.
Kind of opens the door to the discussion of all those other issues.
Well, it depends, because even the groups that don't practice female genital cutting have found that human rights education has been very powerful in changing many aspects of their lives. I mean, there are early marriage practice, child marriage in Senegal, under 15 girls who are married at 12 and 13, but people are deciding to stop that now. They needed information. There was not school for women who could not speak French. And this was one of our big campaigns, was getting national language education to people. Tostan works in 22 African languages. We're in 7 countries working to educate people so they will have the information they need in their own language. This is so critical. It's not just English or French that can take on these issues that are so deeply entrenched in the cultures.
Molly Melching's story is told in Amy Molloy's new book, However Long the Night. It's published by HarperOne. And my thanks to both of you for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.